Thank you, David. That news sponsored by Kaplan Law Firm. Welcome to the evening. I'm Catherine Lake. Kelly Pope is here. We have guests. We have exciting things. We are back on a Monday night. Hi, Kel.
Hey, how are you?
We got Monday nights for the next 5 weeks. You're taking 1 week off. What are you going to do? Are you going to California? You're going to go out and get some sun? What are you
going to
do?
I'm going to Martha's Vineyard. No,
oh,
I've already been to
going
California.
East. Okay, yeah. You're going east this time. That'll be nice.
Yeah.
Well, Kelly and I get a chance to get on the air here for the next few weeks to fill some time for you and to educate you a little bit. True crime is so popular among so many friends of mine. I got to tell you, they're all like, this is so fascinating.
What are your friends like?
Well, some, you know what? There are probably fewer criminals in my posse than yours because you keep bringing on these great guests who have had some stories, have some past they don't mind sharing with us.
We all have a past.
We all have a past. Well, let's kick it off. Where are we going to start tonight? You emailed me like 20 minutes ago and said, new story. We got to talk about this.
We have a guest with us tonight. And Bill Cressy's here. And I think it would be fun to talk about the news because there's something that has happened in the news that might impact all of us, which is this breach stuff.
With Capital One.
With Capital One.
Now, Bill Cressy, how do you know Bill?
Bill and I, we both are colleagues. We teach forensic accounting, so we're fraud people.
Yes, I am. I teach forensic accounting and fraud examination at Governor State University.
Very good.
And we are co-host of our podcast called Dupe of the Week, where we get together and we talk about dupes.
Yes.
So I guess this Capital One is sort of a dupe, sort of.
Well, yeah, it falls into the fraud category, so.
Well,
yeah.
You all come up with the different terms for things, and the red collar, and the white collar, and the duping, and the fraud. So is duping versus fraud different?
Pretty much synonymous.
I sort of think duping is more casual, where fraud is more
organized.
Yeah, a little bit more
larger.
Organized.
So
there's mens rea involved. Ooh, how about a Latin
what
term?
Word? Where did that come from, mens rea?
It comes from my legal background.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a lawyer, too.
I'm a lawyer.
And mens rea means?
Evil mind.
Evil mind. And it really comes up in the law. They use that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Evil is such a subjective thing. Just, you know, did a bad thing.
But it's as opposed to, well, it just accidentally happened.
Okay,
now,
okay.
You intended to do an evil act.
Okay.
So, like, when I think about a dupe, like, if I took my son to the movies and they asked me the question, is he over
under
12?
Right.
Yeah, but I know he's about to turn 14.
Yeah.
Eh, you know, I'm sort of duping the movies.
Okay.
You know, but
that's not fraud. That's a big word.
But then if I want to manipulate the financial statements, that's a little bit more complicated.
That's fraud.
You start using whiteout, you know you're in trouble.
Gotcha. Well, if you're using whiteout, you're really in trouble.
It's way past
trouble. You're not even that good a fraudster.
You're,
you know.
You're bad.
Your whiteout always looks like a different color.
It does.
And it's like a little bit
viscous,
like a vanilla looking color.
Well,
yeah,
actually, yeah. There's a new type of fraud that just developed where whiteout is key, and that has to do with you get the bank app where you use your smartphone to take a picture of your check you want to deposit.
Oh yeah, I do that all the time.
Well, those things can't tell the difference between whiteout and
whiteout. Oh, that's a good one.
And so you get a check that's made out to somebody else.
White
out the payee,
all
white out
it.
The amount,
yep.
And then just fill in the thing, deposit it into a account that you set up really quickly. The check clears, then you
empty out the account.
Let's
try it. Let's test the system.
Okay, what are you doing?
I've actually seen it happen.
Oh,
have you
seen it or done it?
Not done it, because I am Professor Fraud. I study fraud, but I do not commit fraud.
You have to sort of test pressure, you know, test, penetrate, see if you can penetrate the system.
Well, I was called in on a situation where somebody was victimized this way.
So now we're instructing people the many ways you can commit fraud. I don't even think we have to instruct people. I think they're going to come up with them one after another, day after day, year after year, and it's just going to get worse. And Capital One is just another tip of another whole iceberg.
Well, which is, and I imagine Kelly agrees, one of the great things about studying this in academia is, you know, unlike, you know, 14th century French literature, they're not making any more of it. You know?
Sure? Yeah.
This is constantly being
ever
innovated,
evolving.
You know?
Yeah. So I want to bring somebody else into the conversation. So one of the things that I do when I teach my graduate forensic accounting class at DePaul is we have a lot of guests that come in. And so one of the guests that stays on my mind often is Brett Johnson. And Brett's going to join us and hop into this call because, Brett, you just freak me out. You scare me. And I'm going to tell you why. One, when I saw the headline about Capital One, I said, oh, Brett's probably so excited about this. He's probably sitting rubbing his hands.
sinking my teeth into this.
As long as he's not flying to the Cayman Islands with his suitcase
right after.
Cash.
Yeah.
So, Brett,
thanks for joining us, Brett.
Hello, Brett.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for bringing me in.
So, Brett, what did you think when you saw the headline today?
You know, what I thought is, when I give a presentation, part of the presentation that I talk about is how cybercrime is not rocket science, how a lot of these breaches are not sophisticated breaches. And if you look at what Paige Thompson did, she was a software engineer. She worked for a cloud services provider that had hosted some of Capital One's data from 2015 through 2016 is when she worked there. So she had access. She knew that the web application firewall was misconfigured. So it wasn't rocket science. It wasn't what we would consider a hacker type of attack. It was someone who knew that the information was there and that had access to it.
So you sound like this is easy. Come on, Paige, make it a little bit harder. That's how you sound.
Yeah, this is not a complicated attack. This is not a complicated breach. This is someone who was an insider who knew that there was an exploit available, and she took advantage of that.
So, Brett, tell us, why are you an expert in this area? Why do you know? Why do you know so well?
That's a good. It bears repeating, Brett. It bears repeating.
It does, I guess. So the Secret Service labeled me as the original Internet Godfather. The way that I got that title is that I built the first organized cybercrime community. It was called Shadow Crew. It was a precursor to today's darknet and darknet markets. It laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels operate today. I was convicted of 39 felonies. Those convictions had to do with refining modern financial cybercrime as we know it today. So these types of breaches, stolen PII, phishing, any type of financial cybercrime you could imagine that's still popular today, we created that kind of stuff.
How proud you must be.
Not proud at all. I don't think there's any pride in stealing money or information from people.
All I have to say is, wait, that was you?
Yeah, really.
I'm beginning to rethink.
Yeah, that was this idiot you're talking to.
Beginning to rethink being one of Kelly's friends here. You know?
Friends like these.
Considering
right?
The corral of friends she has, yeah.
Well, now, I was interested in one of the aspects of this article. Capital One was in bed with, and I'm going to drop a name here, Amazon. Amazon's getting into the dollars. Either helping funnel them, helping—I don't know what the deal is. How did Amazon get involved in this?
I was not going to say anything about AWS, but more than likely, the cloud services provider that Paige Thompson was working for was Amazon's cloud services,
AWS.
That's
right. Yeah.
So they were just hosting the data on the cloud servers, and then The web application firewall was just misconfigured. So if you look at what a web application firewall is, a WAF, it's a different type of firewall than a traditional firewall. It better filters the information that's coming through. It allows access a little bit easier. If it's not configured properly, there are several ways that an attacker can get access to that data. They can override the rule systems. They can put double URL commands in there, get access like that. So obviously, Paige knew one of these ways to get through the firewall, did that, got the data, and, of course, posted it to GitHub.
Yeah, so I actually was involved in a situation with Amazon's, you know, services. And, yeah,
sure.
If they left essentially a back door open and people could right in.
Is that an Amazon common problem, or is that a common problem with a lot of different servers? It can happen anywhere.
The problem is if you don't know what you're doing on these configurations, as I forgot this other gentleman's name, but as he said, you leave a back door open. So, and if someone knows where that back door is, it's easy enough to walk in and take whatever you want.
So, Brett, when you are an employee of a company, Do you sit down and say, let me play around and look where all the holes are, where I can find the back door? When you were doing your heyday and your cyber criminal days, because you're not doing that anymore, we know. Did you sit around and say, how can I infiltrate this system? Did you think about things like
that? I did, and what a criminal does, so we're not talking about an insider like Page, because Page had insider information on that. But what an outside attacker would do is research, research, research. So when I was researching at Target, typically what I would do is find out what security system they used. You can find that usually posted in terms of service or whatever security company they're using will advertise them as client. Then you research that security company. You start testing or looking for information about breaches. You read indictments, any number of things to gain as much information as you can about the specific target that you're using or trying to attack. Once you do that, you start testing the system. So basically, you're going to start feeling out where the holes, where the vulnerabilities may be until you find one. Now, sometimes you can't find one, so what do you do at that point? You just go to the next victim down the list. When you do find a vulnerability, at that point, you start testing to see what you can get into. You start trying to cover your tracks. You do these test runs until you're sure everything's going to work out all right. Then you go in hard and fast and steal as much information as you possibly can, as fast as you possibly can.
So one value we have tonight, Bill Cressy, is a lawyer.
That's me.
So what do you think's going to happen? What do you think's going to happen to Paige?
Depends on how much she knows, because you would know that better than I.
She probably just wasn't using whiteout.
Well, yeah, that's right. But they might cut a deal depending on what information, if it's of any value that she can give them.
Well, let me do this. Let's take a quick break, and we're going to get a little bit more of your thoughts on that, Bill. And Brett, if you can hang on with us, I think you've still got some more insights. I've got certainly a couple questions for you as well. So let's do that. We've got Kelly. I'm Catherine. We've got Bill. We've got Brett. We're talking true crime again on WGN. Welcome back. It's WGN. I'm Catherine Lake. Kelly Pope is here. We've got our guest, Brett Johnson, and Internet Godfather Brett Johnson and Bill Cressy. I almost gave you the credit of being the godfather there, Bill.
And I am Professor Fraud.
And you're Professor Fraud. I need that title in there as well. And Brett was on the line with us. We're talking about this, well, true crime in general, and this Capital One breach that has me sweating a little bit. I don't actually have a Capital One card in my wallet right now.
But what's in your wallet? Apparently Paige Thompson's hand.
So I don't have one of those, but I have others. And I, as far as I'm concerned, what Brett said to us last week, Kelly, I think it was, or 2 weeks ago, I'm already on the dark web. Everybody in the studio is in the dark web already. So why is this special? Brett, why don't you tell me, why is this special?
The reason this is special is the type of information that Paige was able to get. So you had credit scores, you had credit limits, the balances, the payment history, contact information. You had 140,000 Social Security numbers. You had 80,000 bank account numbers. So it's the type of information that's out there, stuff that is important to criminals. So, yes, your information is out there and for sale now. But you couple your information that's for sale now with the information that Paige basically posted for free on GitHub, and you've got the ability for a criminal to use all that together to commit crimes against you.
Hey, Brett, do you think Paige knew she was doing something wrong and just didn't care?
Absolutely she did. Did you see the Twitter feed where she posted this stuff?
I did.
You know, it's a trick question. She was going to try and trick you. What did she post? I don't know this.
That's called a leading question.
It's a leading question.
It is a leading question. So she posted. Let's read some of this. I basically strapped myself with a bomb vest, effing dropping Capital One's docs and admitting it. I want to distribute those buckets, I think, first.
Oh,
they're SSNs.
Wow.
With full name and DOB. So she knew she was breaking the law, and she went right ahead with it.
They probably should have given her that raise she wanted.
Seriously?
Yeah. So
do you think that would have stopped it?
Probably not, but I mean, where do you begin?
Probably not.
So, Brett, I'll tell you why I was thinking about you also this afternoon. Is someone sent me a link to get my money from the Equifax settlement. And so, and I was like, okay. Is this real or is it not?
But so there's a link, many.
And it says Equifax data breach settlement. And it says check your eligibility. Use the form below to find out information if your information was impacted. Now, I know mine was, but you put your name and then it asks you this. The last 6 digits of your social security number. When I saw that, I said, I went back to the presentations that you do in my class, and I'm like, you must be crazy if you think I'm going to put my 6 digits of my social security
number
in.
Four is bad enough, or is it just any?
I'm not putting any. My last name and my 6 digits.
No, you shouldn't
digits.
Put any.
If you can't trust Equifax with that information, well, wait a second.
Oh, that's right. It's probably not Equifax asking, right?
Well,
that's
actually,
the whole.
And let's be
actually,
fair.
They are. They are.
So they're giving you $125 if basically no one claims the payment. If all 148 million Americans claim that payment from Equifax, they don't get 125. They get 31 cents a piece.
31 cents about check plus or minus. Cut me a check. That's funny.
It costs them a dollar to print the check and mail it out, you know.
And you guys understand all this so well, and it's also so, you know, it doesn't scare you at all. You kind of, you probably all have your credit ratings frozen and everything already. You're informed. The rest of us out there are sweating bullets that this is just, again, another iceberg coming to take our boat out. And I know, Brett, that you will tell me, you monitor your accounts, you freeze your credit, you get a password monitor. I got all that in place, but I'm still thinking there is nothing good coming down the pike.
You're absolutely right. There is nothing good coming down the pike. Right now, the fastest growing form of identity theft is called synthetic fraud. Federal government issued a white paper the other day that basically says, hey, this crime is not going anywhere anytime soon. It's going to continue, and it's going to continue to grow. That's the type of problem that we've got, and it's going to take regulation. It's going to take a fundamental change in the way that credit is given in this country and monitored in this country. It's something that we as consumers cannot do. It's going to take regulation. It's going to take the companies doing that. And to be honest with you, there's so much profit that's being generated right now. There's no impetus for the companies to act on that. There's no impetus for the government to regulate any of this stuff yet.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like you're making sense to me. There is impetus. There's crime going on. Why wouldn't both government and all companies want to join hands with us consumers and fix this problem? Why are they disincentivized by profits?
Sure. So look at Equifax, for example. Equifax, basically the breach compromises 148 million Americans. That's what we know about, 148 million. But how does Equifax handle that? They handle that by giving you a year of free monitoring.
Mm-hmm. And you said the free monitoring doesn't
monitoring
even work,
after.
Brett.
And doesn't even work, right?
That's what you say in my class.
No.
Yeah.
No, the monitoring, you need a credit freeze. That way it stops an attacker from getting your credit report. The monitoring, come on, man, that's useless.
It's,
I don't
it's
need
yesterday's
that.
News,
you
right? Freeze. Yeah, you were hacked. Thanks for the info.
And who's providing the credit monitoring? Is it a division of Equifax? So then they're just moving the cash from the left pocket to the right pocket.
Wow.
That's it. So they've made more money off the breach than they could have possibly made prior to the breach.
Capitalism, you gotta love it.
Gotta love it from Capital One Capitalism. Yeah. I don't. There's no better credit card than others. There's no good bank, bad bank, right? They're all susceptible. They're all guilty. They're all involved, right? Not involved like
absolutely.
They did
and
this,
I want to be fair.
Yeah.
I want to be fair to Capital One. I've worked with Capital One. They have come a long way as far as really implementing good security protocols. The problem is that you've got a system, and it's that way with every company. Every company, you cannot defend every single attack vector, especially when you've got some insider like Paige Thompson that's aware that there's a problem with the servers.
And it goes back to, you know, establishing that right employee culture, making sure people, if they see something, say something, like they tell us at the airport. But
well, that's why I put all my money into Bitcoin.
No, see, now that is not even funny. Facebook has just said they're going to come out with some cash somehow, but they're going to say it's not going to happen right away. We got to iron out some things before we start letting Facebook make money, right?
Oh, yeah, they're not making money at all.
Can the news guy ask a question?
Yes, please, David, ask a question. You got Brett Johnson, who's in...
Brett, you're the one I wanted to ask the question of. What is it going to take for some of the European attitude, which is my data is mine, not yours, to finally penetrate the minds of Americans who have simply
abdicated
literally any control over their information, who gets to collect it, how much of it they get to collect, and how long they get to keep it.
It's a good question.
It's going to take a catastrophic breach. It's going to take some sort of catastrophic attack. You're going to have a major bank hit, but not only hit for information, hit for cash.
Right.
That's what it's going to take. When you see something like that, when it really affects consumers' wallets, when they go to sign into their bank account and they see a balance of zero, at that point, people are going to stand up and want action taken. Mm-hmm.
But I think you really need a cultural change. In Europe, there's always been that culture of keeping this stuff private. During the break, Kelly and I were talking. Remember the day where you would print on your check your social security number and your driver's license?
I was a cashier at Brindle's. I remember that. And someone would write a check, and you'd make a little table, and you'd put their driver's license number and all of their information.
Anything you can give me.
But you would print them on your check when you ordered
it
from
the
bank.
That's right. You would print it.
I mean, this was the culture that we came from. So it's going to take that entire cultural change. No different than getting credit cards with chips in them.
You're killing me because I got another question and I don't have time to ask it right now. So everybody hang on. Nobody move. We're talking cybercrime, the Capital One breach. We got Kelly. We got Brett. We got Bill. I'm Catherine, and this is WGN. Any second now. Thanks for tuning in to 720 WGN. My name is Catherine Lake. Kelly Pope is here. She is a doctor of accounting at DePaul, and her partner in crime, also a doctor as well in accounting.
Well, no, but I've got like 4 degrees and a law degree,
you
which
know
is
the
a
numbers.
Juris doctor.
I got it.
And I go by Professor Fraud, and we've got the godfather of cybercrime.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of nicknames.
So we do.
If Marvel is listening, okay, I think we've got action figures coming.
Ooh, you know? I think we could. Brett Johnson is that cyber criminal. Brett, thanks for hanging on with us. I had one more question. We're talking about this Capital One breach, and you guys are all comfortable talking about what they've done, and the fact is we're all in the dark web. But then you mentioned that Europeans have done a better job at maintaining their information close to the vest. And that confused me because I think of us as an international world now. Everything's everywhere. Capital One's all over Germany, I'm sure. But is that not the case? Are we really that far behind the eight ball?
Well, I like to think we're about 5 years behind the eight ball, maybe 10.
Wow.
And the problem for me is we as Americans, we're very individualistic. Europeans are not like that. Europeans are people who have grown up together. They worry more about the community than we do in America. And I think because of that, we're just worried about ourselves. So I think I hate to get into politics, but I think that's why we have the president that we have now. It's because of this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Until we get to the point where we care about each other, I think we'll continue to see these types of problems.
I feel like we need to sing We Are the World now.
Right now. Can you cue that up for us?
Well, I think David Jennings brought it up about the way Europeans are. And again, you don't want to make stereotypes about different nationalities and such. But in Europe, they've always been very close to the vest with their private information. Like there, you can be written up if you're a company and you distribute the company telephone book so that people can mail Christmas cards to each other. That's a violation of the law over
Interesting.
There.
Interesting. And we broadcast laws. That we broadcast, all over our company all the time.
We've been much more open with a lot of our private information where many Europeans are much more tight-lipped with it. And again, we're suffering the consequences from that because, as you say, there's an international element to fraud and such in that I like to say fraud never sleeps because while we're awake here, there's someone on the other side of the globe who is working hard to separate you from your money.
Deutsche Bank has got problems too, don't they? I mean, Bank of London, everybody.
Everybody, yeah.
Everybody. Yep. So, David, you just sit down, buddy. There's no more crime than here than any place else.
Bitcoin.
That's Bitcoin. Right. Yeah, she's going to Bitcoin. So, is there anything else we want to discuss with Brett, or should we move on to our next thing? What do you want? Do you want to let Brett go? Okay, Brett. Thank you so much for staying up late again and helping us navigate through this mire.
Have a great night.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate
it. Nice meeting you, Brett.
Really nice.
Nice meeting you.
Nice for him to do this for us and to be so honest, too. And what does he do for a living now? Do you know what Brett does? He can't be a white hat, you said, right? Because he was a black hat. So he can't be a white hat now? I'm quoting you on the air for something you said off the air. Now you don't know what to say.
He's kind of a mauve hat. How about that?
Covering your face in radio doesn't really help, Kelly. he's a mauve hat.
He does a lot of workshops and training and really helps people protect themselves.
So he's a white hat behind the scenes. He can't be an official, like, work for GE as a white hat, but he can do what he does. That's excellent. All right. So what do you want to do next? What do you want to talk about next?
Well, we're going to talk a new aspect of crime, which is this area called red collar crime. And it's funny because I think a lot of people, when they hear true crime, they often think of murder. Mm-hmm. And when I think of crime, I think of accounting and finance a lot. And a lot of the stories lead to, I think all roads lead back to the money anyhow. But red collar crime is when you have white collar crime that results in murder. And I have a friend and colleague at the University of New Mexico named Richard Brody, who just has a fascinating research area. And so I spoke with him on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And
his main interest is fraud and true crime, just like you said.
Oh, yeah. But the aspect is red collar.
But the red collar is the emphasis that he's sort of fallen into. And
he actually created this. He and Frank Perry, who's an instructor at DePaul, came up with this term.
Okay.
So they coined the term and do a lot of research. And most of the cases that we see in the media are about red collar. We just don't use that term.
Exactly. And I want to come back to something I said to you a few weeks ago, which is I find it fascinating and kind of aggravating that we have to have all these different names for the different levels of crime when really you're just a murderer. You did it for money and okay, it's a red collar, but you really are just a bad human being and you're a murderer.
Knowing the type of scheme, I think, helps us understand the kinds of controls we have to put around it. So,
interesting.
So the name helps.
It does. It helps you signify what exactly that transpired in that crime. Okay, so we have a little bit of Rich Brody. Do you have it ready? A little clip? Okay, so Ashley's ready for us. This is Rich Brody, the department chair and professor at University of New Mexico, discussing this main interest of fraud and true crime and red collar crime with Kelly this week.
So, Rich, thank you for joining us on our true crime segment. If you could, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. My name is Rich Brody, and I am the department chair at the University of New Mexico. I'm also a professor here and have been in academia for about 30 years after having careers in both public and private accounting. And my main area of interest relates to fraud and true crime issues.
So when I say true crime, it means something. When I say true crime to you, it means something else. What does it mean to you?
Well, you know, I am fascinated by real world stories, and some academics are criticized for being in their ivory towers, but I've always been interested in issues that affect most people on a daily basis. And so for me, when I think about true crime, I think about real cases relating to areas that I am interested in, fraud areas primarily, and the focus being on very practical research and practical presentations. I like people to listen to me speak, listen to me present, and feel like not only did they learn something new, but they're going to have, I'll even say, a better life because of what they learned.
You've made your career on developing a new term. Your term is a little grim. So if you could tell us a little bit about your area of expertise.
Sure. And I'm glad you got to say that first. It is very grim. And a lot of the presentations that I do, I call it scared straight, the white collar crime version. And what that really leads to is this area of red-collar crime. And my guess,
red collar crime. Can you say that again? Red collar crime.
Red collar crime, which amazingly, very, very few people have heard of. But every time I do a presentation, it's one of those show of hands. How many of you have heard of red collar crime? And unless they've had me as a professor, there's usually no hands that go up in the air. When we talk about red collar crime, what we're basically addressing would be white collar criminals who end up in the violent crime arena. And we've gotten to the point now where we can actually be very specific. White collar crime criminals who commit murder are called red collar criminals. So we could also refer to this as fraud detection homicide.
A lot of times then when we're watching shows, movies, we're really watching red collar crime stories a lot of times.
We really are. And I think that your listeners are going to find out once they get a better feel for what red collar crime is, they're going to notice, hopefully not every day, but they're going to notice when they're reading the newspaper or watching the news and they see a case being described, they may say to themselves, gosh, I wonder if this was a red collar crime. So when we talk about red collar crime, what we're really seeing is that these red collar criminals, they have the mindset that when someone is potentially uncovering a fraud that they committed, that they rationalize that the best solution to this situation is to actually kill the person.
So their rationalization is death. When you think about the fraud triangle, or are we talking about the fraud diamond yet? But when we think about the fraud triangle, we think about opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. So their rationalization is, or their way out is killing someone.
Right. And we actually, and I work a lot with Frank Perry, who actually coined the phrase himself, red collar crime. And I saw a brief little article that Frank wrote many years ago, and we ended up connecting. And that's really how I got into this, trying to extend the concept a little bit more. But we have something that we call the fraud concealment homicide triangle.
Please explain what that is, the fraud concealment homicide triangle.
Right. So believe it or not, it's the exact same elements that you find in the fraud triangle. It's pressure, opportunity, and rationalization. But the issue is somewhat different. So if we think of a situation where someone has committed a fraud and someone else is now aware of this, so it could even be that the fraudster told someone that they committed a fraud because it makes them feel better to get that off of their chest. But now if we take this fraud concealment homicide triangle, the pressure is somewhat different. Usually when we talk about the fraud triangle, the pressure is, you know, I embezzled from my employer because I have a gambling addiction or a drug habit. In the fraud concealment homicide triangle, what we're dealing with is what's going to happen if it becomes public information that I committed a fraud. I'm likely going to go to jail. It's very likely going to hit the newspaper. Any respect that I have is going to be gone in the community. I will suffer financial losses. It's actually also embarrassing. My family may suffer, loss of status. So the pressure that these criminals feel is quite high.
So it's interesting how the human mind works, because one would think that by killing someone would not necessarily be the solution to your fraud scheme.
Right. And really what this comes down to is most of the people that are doing this, they probably don't have a history necessarily of violence. In many of these cases, it's almost a snap decision that someone makes. And again, they're just kind of thinking of the consequences of their actions. And instead of taking responsibility for those actions, they view this very darkly as a way out. And of course, most of us would probably say, well, killing one person isn't going to make the problem go away.
It's like the trolley cart. Do you ever do that in your course, the trolley cart dilemma?
Yes. And you know, with the trolley car, you know, we're giving someone, we'll call it an ethical dilemma, and they really have to think about it. You know, do I want to steer the car this way and only one person dies, or do I want to let it go on its current course and kill six people? You know, and so the easy answer that people often give is, oh, well, of course, I rather just kill one instead of six. But you're actually put in the position where you're making that decision. In this case, with these red collar cases, what really complicates things is trying to figure out after the fact, why did this happen? So let's say the police show up at the restaurant I mentioned previously, and they locate a deceased individual in their car, and there's a gunshot wound. Their first inclination might be to try to see, is there anyone else around? Could this have been a suicide? And if it were in fact a murder, how likely are they to say, oh, this could be related to a white collar crime? And the answer is they're not likely to say that at all. And so what really complicates things with these red collar cases, maybe an example would help. Let's say I've stolen from my employer and I feel terrible about it now and I want to unburden myself, so I call you. Kelly, you're not going to believe what I did. I embezzled from my employer and I feel terrible about it and I don't know what I'm going to do, but you know, hey friend, thanks for listening. What happens 6 months later when I start getting a little crazy in the head and I say, oh no, I told Kelly what I did and she's going to turn me in. I just know it. So I need to take her out. Mm-hmm. And let's say I do. We go to dinner, the whole scenario I described before. Well, now the police show up and they find a body in a car. Where's the connection between the two of us? You know, the gain that I had from embezzling occurred months ago, 6 months ago, more than 6 months ago, and you may have no connection whatsoever to the embezzlement that I committed. So if you think about how difficult this can be for law enforcement, it's really, really difficult. And, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do is go out and talk to law enforcement folks to kind of plant a seed in that they now, when they show up at a crime scene, they have to think about the fact there could be financial motives behind this murder.
That's interesting because that's something that is new in terms of how I'm sure a police officer or anyone in law enforcement is thinking about these cases. Because oftentimes, all things lead back to money.
That's right. And, you know, I've developed a little research project that I do with little scenarios. And generally what I'll do, if I'm going to go somewhere and give a speech, I'll ask the organizer, can I send out some materials in advance? Now, at this point in time, they don't know what red collar crime is. They've probably never heard the term before. And these little scenarios are meant to be an educational tool. So there might be five scenarios, and each scenario asks the law enforcement individual to respond to the riskiness of a situation. So for example, scenario one might say, you're going to serve a warrant to Joe Smith, and Joe just got out of prison for second degree murder. What is the riskiness on a 0 to 10 Likert scale, what's the riskiness of serving a warrant at Joe's house? And, you know, most people, I mean, I have all the statistics based on hundreds of responses. I would say that the average response is probably around a 9 out of 10. The next scenario would probably be somewhat less violence related. So it might say, in this scenario, Joe Smith got out of prison for stealing a car. What is the likelihood of this, or how risky is this situation? And then, of course, when we get to the final scenario, it says something like, Joe Smith stole someone's identity. You have enough evidence to arrest Joe Smith. What is the riskiness of serving a warrant? And in that case, the average ends up being like a 2 or a 3. And because folks don't know about red-collar crime, they're not really thinking about the fact that it still could be a violent situation. And I am certainly not criticizing law enforcement. And when you talk to law enforcement folks after they know what red-collar crime is, they will often say, well, we treat every situation the same. But in the real world, that really doesn't happen. And so then you provide the audience with example after example of how these, what they believe are white-collar criminals, can very easily become red-collar criminals and engage in acts of violence.
Wow, really nice interview, Kelly. Well done. That is you talking with Rich Brody, the department chair and professor at University of New Mexico, about red-collar crime. And you say he's one of the ones who sort of coined that phrase.
He did.
Oops, I got to give you a microphone. There you go.
He did, and it's a research area. So he writes a lot of papers, does a lot of workshops on this, and probably scares the audience half to death.
I mean, he really should and does. And I was interested in a couple different things that you touched on with him, and we'll play the rest of the interview after the top of the hour. But and you said it out loud, all crimes seem to lead to or stem from money.
They do. And I think one of the reasons why Rich's presentations are so valuable is you think about it. If I thought that Bill was stealing money and I approached him, I said, Bill, I discovered that you're stealing money.
Who told you?
It could be really dangerous. You know, mm-hmm. it really forces you to realize why you need to follow the proper controls when you are all the HR documents that you probably never read when you started your job of how to report an issue. You really need to do that, because me approaching Bill could end up being very dangerous. Bill could get really nervous. And instead of saying, I'm so sorry, I'll never do this again, he could panic.
He could panic.
And he could kill me.
Hop and into that fraud triangle.
And that's really what Rich's work is about.
I don't like it being so personal, Kelly.
It wouldn't have to be about you.
I would not do that.
Of course. You wouldn't. Yeah. That's what everyone says, right. And then you kill me.
Right. Well,
yeah, okay. Yeah, I would. Yeah.
And the fact that police think that they're treating everybody the same way, but not in advance, they should be looking at, you know, this could be some polite society murder, and they need to be able to trace back how and why. Right.
Well, financially. I think it's one of the reasons why you find you and I doing a lot of workshops with law enforcement and talking about some of the basic accounting things and making sure you can read a financial statement and you understand some of those financial documents, because it could lead back to money.
Do the high crimes, the big guys, all have to, you know, the drug lords, for instance, drug lords, you think it's all cash? I think he's got a room full of cash. He doesn't ever deal with a banking system. Is that a misnomer?
Yeah, because that's where money laundering comes in.
Absolutely.
They have to get the cash into the banking system to get it back to wherever the drugs were coming from. And there's so many wonderful ways of doing it. My favorite was the headline recently, money laundering scheme that took place using laundromats.
Actual laundromats. Come on.
Go
yes.
Figure.
Yeah.
How do they do?
Well, it's one of those things. You have to find a business that uses cash.
Like a nail salon, a hair salon,
a
laundromat,
movie theater,
car wash.
All the places that say we buy junk gold.
Yeah.
Okay. They have all this cash. You come in with junk gold. They give you cash. Now the cash has gone out. They've got gold. Guess what? They can melt that down and slip it across a border.
Oh.
I did a thing with the FBI on art fraud.
We did a panel about that.
Yeah, we did a panel, and the use of art, you roll it up, put it in a tube, take it, on a plane,
right.
And, you know, customs doesn't know that that's a, you know, a rare painting. You tell them, oh, it's a poster.
I made it.
Do a segment on money laundering next.
Oh. Are you?
Okay, yeah. Good stuff.
Okay, yeah. We're going to talk about all that, and it's all coming up after the news, in addition to a little bit more about this Rich Brody, department chair and professor of University of New Mexico interview. And he's going to talk about, because I don't think he did it in that segment, right, the Alzheimer's link. In other words, somebody who can take advantage of somebody who's disabled in any way. That's going to be a heartbreaking part. I'm really lucky, really, really, really lucky that my parents took good care of themselves. My dad worked real hard for General Electric for 40 years and bought himself long-term health care, and we managed to get him into a really nice place. Mm-hmm. But there are so many places that seem really nice and are not, and are ripping people off who can't take care of themselves. And it's just makes my stomach turn. It really does. So we'll talk about that. I also have here, I think the 50 states of true crime. Did you happen to check this out in the New York Times? They had 50 states of true crime. Every state has an infamous crime and often a book written about it that, you know, is probably on a bestseller list. Mm-hmm. And I looked up, of course, you got to look up where you live. Looked up Illinois, the devil in the white city. Did you ever hear that story from way back?
Oh, yeah.
Early Chicago days.
Yeah. They're making a movie of it.
They did, or they are going to?
Yeah.
Oh, finally. Right. Yeah, The Devil in the White City is a look at the murderer during the World's Fair in the 1800s. So that's a really good book, 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Then I looked up New York, which, of course, where I was raised, New York State. The Suffolk County Police discovered the bodies of four women, and that was the Lost Girls crime. So you could read that book. And that's New York City area. Worse, it's Long Island, so it's not actually a New York State thing. It's, you know, it's a whole different place, New York City. we don't really associate well with them. And then I looked at Massachusetts, where I went to school. Where's that? Massachusetts should be close to New York. Oh, it's back a page. Yeah, the brothers examines how the, oh, I can't even say that Russian name, and his brother became the Boston Marathon. I don't want to say their names.
The bombers.
So lots of books cookers. Written about true crime about every state. So if you're curious, if your state has been hit, you can guarantee that it has been.
Every state has.
My state,
I'm originally from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the book that is about true crime, if you are a North Carolinian, is by Jerry Bledsoe.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the book is Bitter Blood, A True Story of Southern Family Pride, Madness, and Multiple Murder.
How proud you must be.
And yeah, when a wealthy mother and daughter were gunned down, gangland style, at their Louisville, Kentucky home in 1984 with no obvious motive, a detective predicted that family was a dark cloud in it somewhere. And so it happened in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So
yeah, in my younger days as a young lawyer, I was a law clerk to federal judge Abraham Lincoln Merovitz right here in Chicago.
Oh, mm-hmm. So you're at Illinois. Okay.
Yeah, but I sat in on a murder trial and it was actually got into federal court because it was insurance fraud.
See, once again, always about the money.
A prominent lawyer who murdered his wife with some corrupt cops.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about this. We've got true crime all night here till 1 with Kelly Pope and me, Catherine Lake, and our guest, Bill Cressy, who is actually a partner in crime with Kelly on her podcast. Yes. Let's continue, though. We're going to get some news. Chicago stories are told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say, play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news is sponsored by Builder Supply Outlet. Here is Vic Vaughn. We don't do a lot of 9-day forecasts on WGN. We try to keep it close to the vest here, but I think I saw that it's going to be sunny for the next 9 days. Partly sunny here and there, but no more rain. This is it. So get
good Lollapalooza weather.
Yes. Yeah. Aren't you forward thinking?
It's going on now.
It starts later this week.
Yeah. I think Thursday.
They've already closed down the roads and traffic is miserable around here.
Is it already started? I haven't looked.
They closed Columbus down. Just a few hours ago.
Yeah, Lakeshore is going to get all messed up. I can just see it from here. That's Bill Cressy. That's the voice you're listening to. He is a partner in crime with Kelly Pope, who's also here, of course, because it's true crime. I'm Catherine Lake. This is WGN. Kelly did the spectacular interview. She has a podcast with Bill, as a matter of fact, and Kelly spoke with Rich Brody, who's the department chair and professor at University of New Mexico. Tell him a little bit again about what we talked about with Rich Brody, and we're going to hit the second half of this interview now.
Yeah, Rich does research in red-collar crime, fellow accounting professor out at the University of New Mexico, and I'm just fascinated by his research and his topic, and I think when you mix financial fraud with murder, you have red collar crime. So think Breaking Bad. If you ever watched that on AMC, this is sort of
New Mexico.
Yeah, when I went to visit him, I went to all the Breaking Bad. So I went to the house.
Wow.
I saw the restaurant. I just had to do the Breaking Bad tour.
but you know, it's funny. Kelly's my partner in crime, and she's fascinated by murder. Should I be nervous?
You should really be. Yeah. All right. A little more of this Rich Brody interview with Kelly Pope.
What I think also is, when you take this conversation outside of law enforcement, when you think about the average everyday employee, we often stumble upon scenarios and situations. And you think about some of the research done by the ACFE and their report to the nations, and they talk about how fraud is often discovered by accident. Using that as our basis, a lot of us might stumble upon something by mistake, and it might be a friend or just a colleague at work, and you might stumble upon something and you might approach them, and then you might approach them again. And so I think why your research is so important is because you are really stressing to people why you have to follow the organization protocols and the compliance process that they have set in place. Because a lot of times we think we can handle these things on our own. And in fact, what your research shows is that it could be deadly.
Absolutely. And it, you could even take it a step further that it doesn't even have to really be work related. You know, a friend could tell you about something that he or she did. You don't work at the same place of business. And that individual who has told you that could subsequently start rationalizing, I shouldn't have told you. You know, and again, the best solution for me here is to eliminate you so that this information can't go anywhere. And this is relevant in all walks of life. So when I do my presentations and I'm asked to provide a summary, the tagline in the summary for the presentations is always, this presentation may save your life.
That's great.
It's really an awareness issue. And, you know, there are many areas that I've looked at where this is very, very significant. And at the top of the list is probably issues relating to the elderly.
Well, let's talk about what happens to the elderly, and maybe we can talk about some cases.
Sure. You know, with the elderly, and I'm a living example of this. You know, my mom lives a couple thousand miles away from me, and I have to rely on other people to help out with my mom. She's got Alzheimer's and is really not able to make all of her own decisions on a daily basis. And so one of the things that I have done is hired a caregiver for her. And many of the examples that I could give you relate to caregivers. And this is where this gets really dark and really scary. There are examples of caregivers who they begin to steal from the individuals that they're taking care of. So I could actually give you a real case. There was a case in Tampa, Florida a few years ago. And the caregiver was taking care of this elderly woman. She was stealing from her. She was stealing her jewelry. She was stealing money out of her bank account. And she began to get paranoid. You know, this elderly woman is eventually going to figure out, or someone else is going to figure out what I'm doing. And the rationalization here, if we go back to the fraud, concealment, homicide triangle, was, I don't want to get caught. This will ruin my life. So in this specific case, she began to very slowly poison this elderly woman. And it took a little while. She was using painkillers. She was using antidepressants. All of this came out in the autopsy report. And eventually, she actually did murder this elderly woman. And the only way that she really got caught was the elderly woman's daughter, who lived out of state, came to town to put on a funeral for her deceased mom, went to the bank to get the money to pay for the funeral, and the account was overdrawn. And that started the investigation and led back to the actual caregiver. And this is not an isolated incident. There are several examples that have made the news where it's apparent that these crimes were actually red-collar crimes. And those are the ones that we know about.
So, Rich, I know that in your presentations you're offering awareness, but when we think about elder abuse and elderly fraud abuse, are there any tips that you leave your audience with?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that you can look at, and there are little tips that come up just in terms of, for example, the most simple thing, reviewing the elderly person's bank account. If you're reviewing the bank account, you'll see the withdrawals. Does anything look, you know, out of the ordinary in this situation? It's like a lot of things with fraud. The more effort you put into it, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to find something. And so, you know, for me, if I go and visit my mom, I have to make a little bit more effort to look for her valuables. Are they still there? Does it seem like things are missing? And, you know, my mom is probably not going to be the one that's going to tell me any of these things. So I have to kind of figure these things out on my own. You can try to educate folks, but the education really needs to go to the children, not the parents, because in most of these situations, you can tell the parent anything you want, but once they're on their own and if they have memory issues and things like that, it's not going to be very effective. Monitoring or asking bankers to be more involved is a possibility. In some situations, you can have a personal banker, and the personal banker might be aware of situations where things look odd. I had a case here in New Mexico where an elderly woman was being defrauded by a real con artist, and he would dress up in a suit, go to her bank, and he cashed in all of her IRAs.
Wow.
And it makes no sense that this gentleman would do this on behalf of this woman. And the bank, unfortunately, did not ask a lot of questions. And he was very successful to the tune of $600,000.
Wow.
Which was pretty much everything she had, and she had no family, and she was in an assisted living facility. It was just a horrible case to see, but thankfully he was convicted and sent to prison.
Wow. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, because we also have situations where lawyers or accountants might discover a client or a colleague engaged in some fraud type scheme. Any stories or cases where the accountant or lawyer ends up getting murdered?
Oh, yes, there are plenty of those. There's actually a pretty famous case which fortunately had I don't want to say a happy ending, because the only thing happy about it was that the CPA was not actually killed. But we had an individual working for PricewaterhouseCoopers. And driving to work one day, all four tires on his car exploded. And he just happened to be working with the DOJ on a very large illegal investment scheme. And so the odds of all four of your tires blowing up as you're driving to work one day, highly unlikely that something like that would happen. The FBI did get involved. They really could never prove anything. But that was one of the first cases I had ever come across. More recently, actually wrote an article with Frank Perry about an individual, and her name was Sally Rohrbach. And Sally was an insurance auditor for the North Carolina Department of Insurance. And when we think about high-profile jobs, like working for a Big Four accounting firm or something like that and being involved in a very high-profile case, that's one thing. But this was an insurance auditor, and her job was to go to various insurance agencies and investigate anomalies. And so she was sent to an individual's insurance office. She met with him. There were feelings that the individual had probably embezzled insurance premiums, so people were paying their insurance bills, and he wasn't submitting their payments anywhere. He was pocketing the money. Sally was basically questioning him, and just to be blunt about it, the guy murdered her. He beat her to death, dumped her in the woods. They eventually found the body. The trail did lead back to him. They asked him why he killed her, and he said she asked too many questions.
Wow. So what should Sally have done?
Well, you wonder if they've made any changes after this case occurred. In reading about the case and reading the comments made by the public relations people, what they basically said was this was just a typical routine case for Sally. We our insurance auditors do this all the time. They look at the finances. They're looking at the books. We don't expect these people to be put in danger. And so, the easy answer is you don't let people go alone, or you don't let people go to their locations. You force the people to come to them. But that's not going to allow you to have easy access to all their records necessarily. And again, this is just one example. Even though Sally got killed or murdered right at the time that she was interviewing this individual, what if he had followed her home? There's no guaranteed way to stop things like this. My view is that awareness is number one, that people need to think anytime they're involved in a case that involves fraud or potential fraud, they have to think about their own safety. Knowing the risk would definitely be helpful, but sometimes when you explain these things to individuals, they think, this would never happen here. That was just a weird situation. But when you start thinking about the fraudster, how they are thinking, again, going back to our fraud detection homicide triangle or fraud concealment homicide triangle, they're thinking, my life is going to be ruined. My reputation is going to be tarnished. My lifestyle is going to be taken away. My family is going to be, they're going to leave me. It's going to be embarrassing. I'm going to be on the front page of the newspaper. So again, these individuals, we have to recognize how far people are willing to go to protect themselves.
And not only that, Rich, but we also have to recognize that we don't always perceive things as dangerous. I think we are sometimes wildly optimistic to our detriment. And so we don't perceive that approaching someone could be dangerous, especially someone that you know. We don't think about things that way. We are not good at anticipating the risk always.
Absolutely. And as we were talking about a few minutes ago, this happens with regular people like us, but it also happens with law enforcement. I have spoken to many law enforcement organizations, and again, it's one of those things where if you're a law enforcement person, I don't think you want to stand up and say, oh, well, you're right. I don't consider a situation with a white-collar criminal to be as dangerous as I do with a murderer, because your training is you approach every situation the same way. But I think we're really talking about human nature here. And as more people learn about red collar crime and the linkage between a white collar crime and violent behavior, you know, perhaps that will help people understand this better. But again, I think when it comes right down to it, it's exactly what you said. We don't think about people we know as being violent individuals. And this actually helps people when they go on trial, because you've got a jury looking at this normal looking person on the stand or in the defense box. And it's one of those things where you're basically saying, well, wait a minute, that person kind of looks like me. You know, they even kind of have a job like me. And if they're going to defend themselves and say, well, I didn't do this, it's not that hard to convince people, and certainly until they see all the evidence. You know, I'm just like you. I mean, I wouldn't do anything like this.
Well, this has been a eye-opening experience. I hope that our listeners enjoy what they've learned. Red collar crime is the term that we were talking about. And it's often when white collar crime results in murder. And thank you so much for Dr. Richard Brody. You've been amazing. You've scared me to death. Well, not really to death, but you know what I mean. But I think it's always good to be aware, because often, you know, you think about how common and popular true crime is right now. And we're watching red collar crime stories every time we're typically watching a show like this. So thank you so much for offering your insight and your expertise. It has been great.
Thank you, Vic. It's Catherine Lake and Kelly Pope and her guest, Bill Cressy, who is a partner in crime with Kelly. Kelly, of course, as you know, is a DePaul. Let's just say DePaul. Instructor of accounting doctorate. And of course, as so is Bill, also an instructor of accounting, but at the Governor State University.
That's right.
That has a wonderful venue for concerts and such.
The Center for Performing Arts.
Right.
Yes.
Really nice.
And of course, Kelly and I like the abbreviation CPA.
CPA. So, yeah. That works out well for you, doesn't it? Well, Kelly interviewed Rich Brody, who is the department chair and professor at University of New Mexico, about his main interest, which involves red collar crime. And I was struck by something I'm learning from you, Kelly, that there are these three, this fraud triangle, mm-hmm. that you're looking for someone who has a little pressure. I've got some debt. I got a problem. I got to put my kids through school. What am I going to do? It's the Breaking Bad scenario, right? And then the opportunity comes up. I meet a guy who knows how to make heroin. I think I'll sell it. And then, of course, the rationalization. I've earned this. I should have this. But with the red collar, it sort of shifts the meaning. The pressure becomes, instead of I need the money, I need to cover what I've already done. The pressure is growing. Now I'm going to find an opportunity to perhaps eliminate the problem that I've created by maybe, as Rich put it, confessing to a friend what I did, and I don't feel so good about that person existing knowing what I did. And then the rationalization to, well, I'm going to have to eliminate that person, clearly, because my family is going to be in trouble if I'm put in jail, so I'm going to have to rub that person out. So it's fascinating that there's still this physical structure around your analysis, but it's a little darker mm-hmm. when it comes to the red collar.
Well, I think the fraud triangle works for a lot of situations. So it also works for whistleblowing, because if you think about it, a whistleblower goes through a similar process. What's the opportunity to tell? What's my rationalization? Should I do it? Should I stay involved or not? And then the pressure, too. Like, you know, a lot of times when I'm doing interviews with whistleblowers, they often comment the pressure of keeping quiet.
Can be enormous, I suspect.
Yeah. So although we call it the fraud triangle, the triangle, you know, the words, the indices in the triangle work for a lot of situations, whether it's thinking of murdering someone, thinking about whistleblowing, or thinking about committing fraud. So.
Yeah, and like a three-legged stool, if any one of those parts is missing, usually it doesn't go through.
Right, you know? Yeah. Right.
The crime doesn't go through, or the punishment doesn't go through.
Or the crime doesn't go through, or the whistleblower doesn't blow the whistle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was your most interesting takeaway from that interview with Rich?
How we behave, we don't always know how we'll behave in a situation. Mm-hmm. And so pressure and stress lives on people in different ways. And so we really don't know what we would do if someone approaches us and finds out that we've done something and they approach us with that information. So I think when you look at Rich's cases and you read some of his research articles, you notice that these are everyday working employees, you know, that might have made a mistake, covered it up, and kept covering it up, but just didn't know how to get over it, didn't know how to admit failure, didn't know how to come forward with the information. And so when they're approached, they panic. And panic is a very human feeling. So I think I could relate to a certain point.
Yeah.
To a certain point, you know, that pressure.
Yeah. One of the things that I, you know, listening to that interview, take away from it is, again, the vulnerability of older people.
Oh, yeah.
And how often they are defrauded and attacked. And part of the reason, and I worked with a detective in the Chicago Police special victims unit.
Oh, SVU.
Covers, yeah, that's the New York version.
Oh, okay.
But they do a lot with senior citizens. And one of the things they say is a lot of older people, if they know they've been defrauded, and I was talking about people with dementia and such, but they might know they've been defrauded and they don't tell anyone.
Right. Oh. A lot of times people are embarrassed.
Because they're embarrassed and they think their family will think they're no longer capable of handling their own affairs. So rather than tell anyone, they'll suffer the losses. So if there's any message out of that, it would be, please, families, tell the older folks in your family that if somebody is, you know, trying to defraud you, please come forward. Tell them. We won't think any worse of you for it.
And to keep on it for them, with them.
I was watching an interesting program today. I don't know if you've ever watched The Weekly, the New York Times. It's like a docuseries. And today they had an episode about Facebook, like Facebook fraudulent accounts. And the story that they had was a woman who was duped into thinking she was helping a vet. She ended up giving him
military
vet. And she ended up giving him their life savings. And one of the things that she said why she didn't tell anybody is she was embarrassed.
Of course.
She just didn't feel like, gosh, I can't admit to this.
Right.
So embarrassment is a
big motivator. Which the bad guys, you know, the committed fraudsters know about.
They
exploit it.
Yeah.
Because they know, especially as I say, with seniors, if they defraud a senior, they won't report it to the police. They won't report it to their families.
This episode was about a group called the Yahoo Boys. And it's a group in Nigeria that focuses on very vulnerable people. And the people are a group of women in a Facebook group that are married to military men.
Oh, come on.
So, you know, they're very vulnerable people. Widows, like Facebook group that are widowed women. Mm. You know, so
they know what they're going for.
Yeah, they've got it down. They've worked it out. They know what to go for. And it's horrible. As I think I said in one of our podcasts, there has to be a special place in hell.
It really does.
For someone who exploits someone's heart, you know, this way. And there are so many cases like this in you know, these imaginary people on Facebook, and then they exploit them. They think that they're real. They think they've got a relationship going, and it turns out it's just somebody who's attempting to rip them off.
Facebook is rampant with that, I'm sure. And I will give you a little confession about my own Facebook experience. But I'll tease you with that. And I'm just going to decide if I'm going to actually tell the story. But there's one more question. You went back to Rich, right?
Yeah, Rich and I were, you know, sometimes you have this off-air banter with a person. And so I had one more question that came up. I said, Rich, you know, tell me about a story that just stays on your mind, sort of unsolved red-collar crime
case. Red-collar, again.
And so you'll take a listen to what he shared.
All right.
So, Rich, let's talk about one last case together.
Okay. How about I pick one of my favorites?
All right, pick it. Go ahead.
Okay. And this is actually a very controversial case. If you remember back in the Enron days, we had an individual, one of the executives for Enron. His name was Cliff Baxter. And in 2002, they found Cliff Baxter basically on the side of the road in his car, dead with a gunshot wound to the head. And it was ruled a suicide. However, there is a lot of information out there, some of it written by forensic scientists and things like that, other types of folks like that. Cliff Baxter did not have any of the red flags associated with suicide. He apparently had a good family life. He wasn't known to be suffering from depression. He wasn't known to have mental health issues. But what he was known for was being very critical of Enron's accounting methodologies. And he was getting ready to testify in this case. And he had expressed concern to people around him that he was thinking about getting a bodyguard. And the next thing you know, he apparently commits suicide. So this is kind of an offshoot of the red collar crime area, is to actually tie suicide into this. One of the things that comes up with suicide is, yes, there are situations where an individual involved in a fraud case somehow, either as the perpetrator or even as a victim, may resort to suicide. So we see cases where people are convicted of white-collar crimes, they're given some time to get their affairs in order before they have to report to prison, and they end up committing suicide. However, what makes the Cliff Baxter case so interesting, at least to me, is that I'm not sure he did commit suicide.
An unsolved mystery?
And if you think about it, there are probably many, many, many other examples that would line up with the Cliff Baxter case where, you know, the family comes out and says, there's no way that this individual committed suicide. And so I actually wrote an article about that. I think it is not only relevant to the white collar area, you know, suicide's a terrible problem in our country, and a lot of the information in the article just talks about warning signs and things like that. But to tie it into the white collar and red collar arena, it just tells you that there are situations where on the surface it may look like a suicide, but we argue in this article that we wrote that it's just as likely, or maybe even more likely, that it was actually a murder.
Hey, Rich, I think we have a new project. We need to solve the Cliff Baxter case, yeah?
But then we might become victims.
Then someone's going to be doing red collar crime case about us.
About us. So, yeah, just to be clear, we have no interest in doing any research whatsoever on Cliff Baxter.
Just to be clear. Okay. Wow. But, you know, it's interesting because the relationship or the correlation between suicide and red collar crime, because you're right. A lot of people might just write off some of these deaths as suicides. And when you hear that term, you just sort of back off, you know?
You do. And again, not. No intent here to be critical of law enforcement, but there are numerous cases where one might argue that the suicide determination was made a little bit too quickly, and once the crime scene is contaminated, you can't go back and uncontaminate it. So, again, and when I go and speak to law enforcement, I do emphasize this, that sometimes what things appear to be are not necessarily the case. And so as you're collecting forensic evidence, some of that forensic evidence might involve financial documents.
Because all things often lead back to money.
That's right.
It's no kidding. It always does. Nice interview again. Kelly Pope interviewing Rich Brody, the department chair and professor at University of New Mexico, about red collar crime. What was your biggest takeaway from that story?
Well,
Enron, holy smokes.
I think when you have something that's unsolved, that's always intriguing. I think, Bill, we should have joined forces, put our two forensic accounting classes together and have our students solve this. I was just doing a quick search as I was re-listening to the interview. And listen to this title, The Strange and Convenient Death of J. Clifford Baxter. Enron executive found shot to death. He was 43 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Didn't know that. And they said how odd it is for a key witness to be found shot dead 2 weeks before they're supposed to testify.
Oh, see, that's just so...
How convenient was that?
We're talking about true crime here, people, and it sounds like we're talking about a television show.
Get this. It says, a man, 2 days before he committed suicide,
quote
with
unquote.
Air quotes, he was talking about hiring a bodyguard.
Yeah.
Because he was one of the very vocal employees complaining about Enron. So this is unsolved. We've got to figure
this
out.
I tell you, I'm thinking there's all those people out there getting ready for bed, and boy, are they going to have wonderful nightmares listening to this conversation. Frankly, I'm thinking of hiring a bodyguard.
No kidding. I am now as well. No. We should change the subject. I don't know. I got a phone call from the IRS again. We talked about this last week. I actually got one of those calls. I can't believe it. In the time that it took for us to bring this topic up again, somebody calling me and saying, we have a problem with your So this is the IRS.
We think with an
accent with a lot of people in the background.
Yeah.
I'm not calling you back.
Yeah, and they want you to pay with an iTunes card.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the fraud triangle is fascinating, and it's
that story I was telling about Facebook.
Yeah,
the Facebook fake accounts. That was something that they were asking for too. iTunes cards. Yeah. So they were.
I've got a brand new fraud that my wife just got.
Okay.
A couple of days ago, driving downtown.
Okay.
And she gets an email purportedly from her boss saying, he's in a meeting right now, and would you kindly...
I've gotten this before.
Yeah, kindly stop off on the way home. It's on your way to work, and there's you have to do.
Give me 5 iTunes cards,
or or Google Play cards or something, and we don't have time to bring them in, so just scratch off the back and
so
send the numbers.
So you can see the code, and you can spend it.
Yeah, and then send me an email with all the numbers on it. And
was she even remotely interested in doing this, or did she immediately recognize it as what the?
Well, as she likes to call herself, she is Mrs. Fraud.
That's all she knows.
So she was like, hey, Professor Fraud, look at this.
Yeah.
So it, but again, this is somebody got a hold of email accounts or whatever. And
that happened to 2 of my colleagues at DePaul.
Wow.
They fell for it. I guess they didn't take my class.
No, I guess they were not paying attention.
They ended up, one colleague ended up sending $1,000 to this, who he thought was the other colleague. Got the same email.
Mm-hmm.
You mean professors aren't immune from this?
You know what?
You
let me show you something.
You should be.
Let me show you something. I wrote an article on my Forbes blog about it. And I'll tell you, I can't even remember the name of it, but I think it's... professors, everyone can get duped, even professors. So it was all about...
Or maybe especially professors.
Especially professors. Now, tell me about this trolley car dilemma that you talked about with Rich Brody.
It's a case where you have to make this ethical choice. Do you redirect the trolley car so it only kills one person?
Presuming you're on a trolley car that is out of control and you have control over its direction in some way.
Or do you pick the track where it kills more than one person? And so you have to decide.
So it seems simple, obviously fewer people. But the key is to get the person contemplating this to remind themselves, you're going to have to kill somebody.
Yeah.
There's only one. It's better than 6, but
I just want to know, where am I that I'm driving a trolley car?
See, now you're just busting it up.
Yeah,
now.
I know.
Oh, okay. Well, we're talking true crime. I'm Catherine Lake. It's Kelly Pope here as well. And Bill Cressy is her partner in crime. And you said something about, I'm going to take another minute or two here, the Equifax information. Because remind people what happened with Equifax. Equifax being one of the three.
One of the three big credit bureaus. And they were hacked. And it's known that approximately 150 million accounts were stolen, and that contains your personal identifying information, name, address, but also Social Security number, and in many cases, driver's license numbers and things like that.
This is, what, three, 4 years ago?
Yeah, about three years ago. Yeah.
Big deal. I mean, this is the biggest one of those three ever getting caught up, right?
I even ended up on This Week Tonight with John Oliver because of that. Just a little clip they used of me. But
neat.
Fortunately, I was the setup for the joke.
Not the joke.
Okay. But as far as we know, the information, the trunches of information has not shown up on the dark web yet.
What? Nobody's used it yet?
But we should ask Brett if your information's on, if some of that information's on the dark web.
Because Brett is well acquainted with the dark web.
Well, I'm also acquainted with some people.
Who are acquainted with the dark web. You're making the evil hand gesture.
I'm now doing the stroking my cat on my lap. Supposedly, it has not shown. Usually, when there's a hack, you'll see chunks of this information being brokered on the dark web, and bad guys will sell it and say, "Here's some. It's been verified. Good. Here, I'll sell it to you." You know.
How do you know it's not out there yet?
Because the people, there are other forces out there that are constantly monitoring the dark web and looking at what's being brokered out there. And this stuff hasn't gone out.
Because they know the names. They know the group.
They know what to look for.
Yeah.
And so there's thoughts that maybe whoever took it is planning to do something big and bad in the future.
And that could be for November 2020?
Could. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yes.
Creating people. Creating voters,
so,
perhaps.
Well, yeah. So some more nightmares for people out there as we're heading off to bed.
Awesome. Well, I think we're going to take a little quick break, shall we do? And then we've got lots more. We've got some more dupes to talk about. Kelly Pope and Bill Cressy have a podcast together, and they are scaring the heck out of me on WGN. 11:58. Thank you for sticking around with WGN. I'm Catherine Lake. Kelly Pope is here. She's brought her buddy Bill Cressy. We're talking about true crime. And we've got some favorite dupes that you guys want to talk about in the next hour. And then we also have your friend Nathan Muller. What's his deal?
So Nathan is a guest that comes to my forensic accounting class and shares his story. And he is a former CPA. Used to work for a financial institution, and he's just going to share what happened to him and how he thought through a couple of decisions.
All right. I will confess my Facebook business. They made it really hard to make new personalities on Facebook at first. You thought you shouldn't do it. You thought you couldn't do it. But I had it's not a really hilarious story, but I had a failed adoption. And afterward, I created a girl to help watch the birth mom who kept the baby instead of giving it to us, because I wanted to know what was going on. And I'll be darned if she never accepted my friend request. I never really friended everybody around her. It was like my obsession. In addition to Farm Town, I think I had to do Farm Town with this personality to try and get close to her, because it was ridiculous. But it's not that hard to create a Facebook profile that doesn't belong to you. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that and a whole bunch of other neat stuff after the news with Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic. We've got 9 television screens in this studio at any given time. I got CNN. I think I've got MSNBC or maybe public television over there. We got WGN TV on somewhere, of course. And what's over here? What is this? What do we need this for?
It's Seinfeld.
Is that Seinfeld?
Well, it was before. Three guys and a dog. I don't know.
Why? This is not important to me right now. I need something better.
Two and a half men.
And he's still working. Is that man still working? Seriously.
Which one?
The guy who...
Charlie Sheen.
He was drug-addled for a while, wasn't he?
I think he was working during it, though, right?
He was working during it, losing weight and getting all...
He shows up on TMZ every now and then.
Yeah, but that's sort of... It's what makes it spicy.
Okay. So it's good. All right. Catherine Legge and Kelly Pope and her guest, Bill Cressy, who was a partner in crime on her podcast.
Which is called Dupe of the Week.
Thank you. Yes. Dupe of the Week.
Dupe of the Week.
And I want to hear some dupes of the week.
We're going to hear some dupes.
Yeah, okay, at the end. We'll save it. But you also have this awesome guy, Nathan Mueller, or is it Mueller? We'll find out from him. What is his story? Why are we bringing Nathan on?
We're going to learn a little bit about his story and his background. He is... someone that I met, wow, Nathan, 4 or 5 years ago, I took a group of students to meet him. So we all got in a plane.
Field trip.
We took a field trip. We went to Midway Airport, got on a Southwest flight around 5 in the morning, and we went to visit him at his house and learn from him.
You are an aggressive professor. You took a plane full of kids out?
Well, they're sort of like adults.
Kind of. What Bill's looking awfully. He's
like, where did you get that budget? Professor of the Year award, right?
Yeah, well, you know, there's this thing called Skype.
Yeah, really. Know? Did you
Skype
have to?
It's not the same. Okay. It is not the same. Could we all Skype and do this?
True.
No, there's True. Something we about the live human interaction. So if I want to punch you,
it's going to work out.
I can do that.
Okay, I am hiring that bodyguard.
Yeah, you want to move to Mike 6?
I just had a threat there. I think you just heard.
Well, tell us. You can bring Nathan in here for us. Hey, Nathan. Thanks for joining us.
I'm here.
Nathan,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been so long. This is Kelly.
Hi, Kelly.
How are you, man?
I'm fantastic.
I know you are. You are. It's been like, I mean, we've been emails and LinkedIn messages, but I haven't heard your voice in a really long time. So it's great. I'm glad that you're on the call and you're willing to talk to us a little bit at midnight.
At this hour, yes.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Nathan, let's just get started. When you receive interest from people, what typically is it that they want you to talk about?
You know,
Oh, we just about to have the answer to that question. Did he just drop completely? Nope. There he is. So you're back, Nathan. I can hear you. No, I can't. There you are. Yes. Nathan?
Go ahead.
We're cutting in and out a little bit. And a long delay. Are you with us?
Oh, no.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Wow.
About me and my story has always been the... just taking responsibility for what I did, and people's interest is diverse in that, you know, they want to know what I did, they want to know how I did it, but they want to know why I did it, and they want the personal side of the story too, which I'm willing to talk about, which I think is unique. So
what'd you do? Now everyone's like, what did he do?
What did you do?
They're on the edge of their seats. And it didn't help that you were going in and out, in and out. So we're just like, oh, my God, what did he do? What did he do?
And it doesn't help that the last segment was about fraud and murder. So
tell us you didn't do that.
Hasn't murdered anyone.
No, okay.
Right, Nathan?
I've never murdered anyone.
All right.
I'm sorry. I normally go into situations with people knowing what I did. I embezzled $8.5 million.
Oh. Whoa, good number. From where?
A large financial institution, a large banking and insurance giant called ING.
Oh, I've heard of them.
Who, at the time, you know, they came into the United States. They were very visible, trying to create a presence in the U.S. So, yeah, they were quite well known back in the mid-2000s.
So, Nathan, how do you feel when you say that? I mean, have you, you've said it so frequently now, is it numb to you? Or when you say that, what you did, does it sting a little bit? Like, I want to be in your head right now.
At this point, to have gone through everything I've gone through and to be where I'm at now, you know, and be in a good place to look back at that person and try to comprehend what was going on in my head, what was motivating me, and how I could possibly think that that was in any way a good idea. But yeah, it stings. It's hard. It's hard to deal with still. Definitely.
So what, when you share that fact about yourself, I'm sure people are just amazed, because they look at you and they hear you and they can't imagine that this guy that's standing in front of them would do this, right?
Does he not look the part? Is that what you mean?
No, of course not. He doesn't look the part.
What does the part look like?
Yeah, what does the part look like?
I think when we think of someone stealing $8.5 million, we think of the movies. We think a group of people like Ocean's 11 that have sat for months orchestrating this group of people that are wearing black masks and black clothes. And
$8.5 million, you got to have a lot of people to do that.
Yeah,
and looks like Brad Pitt and George Clooney.
Well, yes,
I think Nathan sort of looks like Brad Pitt a little bit. Okay, right, Nathan?
All right.
I look like George Clooney, Nathan. That's the beauty of radio.
No comments.
All right, I need to get right into this. I need to hear from you, Nathan. How did this come about? Let's get into the story of you and ING.
And keep it simple, because remember, we're not accountants. Well, I'm not an accountant.
Yeah.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. So basically what happened, I took an accounting and I got there. It was a very weak control environment. There was password sharing. There was some big terms when I started there would be, shortcuts and workarounds. It was just an environment of things don't work properly here. And, the environment was get your job done. So as I was progressing there, that was for a different company. Then ING bought the company I worked for. And when they came in...
When the new company came in...
They bought so many different life insurance companies around the United States that they finally figured out, we have all these companies. We need to get everybody on the same system. And they had all this work to do. And so... they just didn't have the time or manpower to do things the right way. So basically what happened was they gave approval authority for check processing, for checks up to $250 to in my co-worker with somebody whose password I had. She was a person that I was very close with, somebody I loved
like a sister, I think that was.
Or was it co-conspirator?
Co-conspirator, loved like a co-conspirator. We're trying to hear piece together a few gaps in our communication here, Nathan, just so you know.
Okay.
You can continue.
The end, but no, you know, we had a very close relationship. So what happened was, in my personal life, I decided that the only way that I could make things work financially
I don't know about you, but I'm having a hard time with this interview. Ashley, can we try and get him on a hard line instead of a cell phone? I can just figure that we can get a better conversation out of a hard line than a cell phone.
Well, I there's something that's as we're working on that filling. That I think he said, and I'm going to do a poll with you two or anybody listening. Have you ever shared a password? Tell the truth.
All the time. I just did it today. Someone just said, send it to me via email. And I'm like, okay, fine.
Oh.
Yeah, I did.
Have you ever shared a password, Bill? Ever.
My life's an open book. I do it all the time.
So what you heard Nathan say was in his work environment, they shared each other's passwords.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when he's sharing that, people are like, oh, no, that's terrible.
His password to get into his computer to do his job for the day.
He shares.
Okay.
But when people hear that, they often are like, oh, that's terrible. Then you ask him, raise your hand if you've ever shared your password.
Everyone says yes. Of course.
Yeah.
So it's very common.
Yes.
And one of the things that he says, or he will say, is he didn't think anything of it. Of course he's never going to do anything wrong.
Yeah.
It's okay for
and
me to
know your password.
And
he presumed she wouldn't either. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, she that was just how their group worked. So she never did anything wrong with it. But that was just sort of like, I know your password, you know my password. So if I'm out of town or you're out of town, then I can go into your computer or go into your system, get the information that I need, and then move on.
It's all about the convenience.
It's all about the convenience. Like you said, he worked in an environment. It was get the work done. We just need to get the work done.
And this is early on. And ing sounds familiar to me because
I-N-G.
I-N-G. And I had an Orange account, Orange Savings account. Is that them?
Yeah.
That was them.
And you
online
said
only.
Ing because that's how the commercials used to be.
Right.
Like they would, it would look like someone was sitting in front of the word.
Bang.
All
yes.
Of
them. Yes.
That's why you said that.
That's right. Because it's from way back. And, mm-hmm. and he was also, this is the gentleman we're talking about who will hopefully get on a hard line eventually here, Nathan Mueller, who ended up embezzling $8.5 million from ING. And that's me, right? I mean, if I had my savings in there, he got it from...
You have $8 million in a savings
account?
Yes,
it was my $8 million that he stole.
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that nice? But I no longer have it, so I'm no longer the millionaire you wish I were.
Darn.
I wish I were. But that is, right? It's from the people who toss their money in there online, right? Well, we'll find out from Nathan. Hi, Nathan. You're back.
I'm back.
Okay. On a hard line, hopefully, we'll get a little better idea. So you're sharing your password with your work coworker, right? Your coworker, and then what?
Yeah, I knew my coworker's password, and in the transition to the new company, we were both given signing authority, so. I know now that I just convinced myself that my only course of action was fraud, you know, was stealing money to get out of debt to be okay. So, I mean, the motivator for me was we were having a child and I wanted my wife to stay home with, you know, our baby and be a stay-at-home mom, but how am I going to pay for it?
There's
so
the pressure.
That was kind of the fraud triangle, that was my pressure to take care of my family. And And I decided that it was not correct. It was just me putting that pressure on myself and me saying this is my only course of action. So I decided to do it, and I went down the path. I started stealing money to pay off my debt, you know. And once I assumed once I paid off my debt, everything would be okay, and my salary would be fine to, you know, cover our expenses. And then spent the summer dealing about $90,000, and then basically after that, it was so easy to do that kind of like it grabbed me to bring me to really get greedy and start stealing money to do, you know, not good things.
So Nathan, you know something that I've heard you say when we visited you in Minnesota was, you, because of the access that you received when you were trained in the new system, converted, never was on this new system, and you were able to see other people's salaries. Do you remember this part of your story?
Yeah.
That just got at you.
There's another motivator.
When you realized that there were people that were making more and you might have been working more than them, or you might have been just more efficient, you were better. And what I love about how you rationalized that was just, that's a very real feeling. That's a very human feeling.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
One of the things I think that's so powerful about your story is people can relate to it. And I'm sure you've told it 1,000 times at this point, but I think it gets to people because they understand. If you think about, guys, if you found out for the same job, someone made 3 times or even 2 times or even $5 more than you, you're going to be like,
what is going on?
Absolutely.
No, that's a very common rationale. in fraud. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, someone in an organization, I should have gotten that promotion, but that person got it. And then every time that person screws up, it's, you're like, see, I would have been better at that.
But a lot of people feel that way. And I think that's why his story is so powerful.
Exactly.
And why it's evergreen. Because people...
Taking care of your family.
Yeah, they get it. They get it.
Of course, opportunity kicks in because, as you said, you got $90,000 and you thought, well, that took care of a lot of problems. Yeah. And it's still a problem for the company. They still haven't fixed their holes. So I'm going to teach them a little lesson and I'm going to get a little ahead.
I wanted to ask you this. Do you find that when you share your story that you see a lot of head nods in the audiences? Do you see a lot of like, yep, you know, I get it. I understand what he said. Do you see that those nonverbal cues from the audiences that you're speaking to?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest things when I speak is people go into my presentation and their first thought is, well, I'd never do that, you know. Mm-hmm. And obviously, before I did what I did, I would have said, well, I'd never do that. And so what people do is there's not necessarily head nodding and stuff, but what happens is people connect with me in that they see that, oh my gosh, I have the same upbringing and the same education and same work history with this person, and I have the same life issues. I have children and I have college debt and I have credit cards and I have this stuff, and I can see how it would happen. And so that's where people really connect with me, is that I was really a normal person, you know.
You were adulting.
Yeah.
Being an adult, that's what you were doing.
That's
adulting.
Funny.
So Nathan, you're the person who actually paid off his student loans, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that was one of the first things I did.
Something else I think that's interesting about your story is, although you might have stolen this money, you did right by the money up until a certain point. So wanting to take care of your family, paying off initially, then the story changes a little bit.
Is this Breaking Bad? I mean, how bad did it get?
Well, I mean, it got to 8.5. But I think your heart was in the right place at first. You know, paying off my credit cards and paying off my student loans and
letting
my wife stay home to take care of our child. Mm. And yeah, that seems honorable, noble, right?
But understandable.
At what point did you change, Nathan, and to refer to something we talked about earlier here, at what point did you become Charlie Sheen?
Yes.
You know, it was a weird transition in that I did the initial fraud. I paid off all my debt. I stopped. Like, everything should have been good at that point. You know, my daughter was born. My wife was staying home with our children. Everything was exactly how I kind of planned it out. And then that's when things flipped. About 6 months after I stopped stealing initially, the thought, literally, I was sitting at my desk, and the thought that popped into my head was, man, you did all that work to steal that money, but you didn't do anything fun with it. So how do we turn this up and, like, do something fun?
Again, very human-like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't buy anything. I paid off debt that nobody knew I had. And then my thought was, well, it was so easy. It was just so easy to do. How can we have some fun with this? And so I didn't have a list of items I wanted to buy. I didn't have any. I just thought, if I steal more money, I bet I can have some fun with it now.
So
and that's when things just got really dark.
So Nathan, at any point, was the fear of getting caught, did it ever enter your mind, even when you were paying off your bills, even before the switch? Like, did you ever think, man, I could get caught doing this? I mean, but if I do get caught, nothing probably will happen.
I assumed from the first check it wouldn't work. And Kelly, we've talked about, with the amount of audits going on, especially in a big financial institution, I have internal auditors, I have external auditors, I have state insurance examiners, I have, at the time, Sarbanes-Oxley testers. I have people digging constantly.
Gosh darn it.
It really puzzled me that people weren't catching it. So I was having this weird thing where I felt like I was going to be caught, but I also felt like they're never going to catch me because they keep not catching me. So it was like a weird duality there where it was really shocking to me that nobody found it.
So is it probably, as you're doing it in the moment, and I want to ask a little bit about what the moments are like, I mean, how this actually occurred. How did you get 8.5 mil out of ING? But as you're doing it, you're thinking, well, in this moment, if someone walks by and sees my screen, or at the end of the day when the audit occurs, I know it's going to happen. Or is it once you're through that, you think, well, there you go. I'm about to walk out. Like you've pocketed something at Target and you've gotten through the little devices at the door. Tell me about a little bit about that moment and the moments between when you're not getting caught.
I mean, so the process, I would literally log into our system as myself, request a check. I would log out. I would log right back in as my coworker since I had her password, and I would approve the check. I would pick it up the next day, and then I had the money.
You just wrote yourself checks.
Most fraud schemes are very simple.
Very simple.
So I think when we think about the universe of fraud, mm-hmm. with the exception of, say, an Enron, most schemes are pretty simple. Yeah. You know, you think about, they're not hard. They're not hard because if they're weak internal controls, which often there are,
that's
big,
the thing.
Small, medium-sized companies, the schemes are simple. You know, what you described is not hard to do.
It really revolves around the password, too, right? It revolves around the password. You've got two people saying, this is a good check.
Yeah.
Nathan,
can I ask, did you ever have like that thrill, that adrenaline rush, and you're like, you leave at the end of the day, and it's like, see ya, suckers?
Yeah.
Oh, every time. And that was a big part of it was a lot of this fraud was very addicting to me, in that it was addicting to get my hands on the check. And, you know, especially there were days I stole $400,000 in a day.
Wow.
And that's insane to go from my first fraudulent check was $1,100 and then up to stealing $400,000 in one day, like
multiple
that's
checks,
crazy. And,
multiple checks at that point.
Yeah, I had the ability to approve up to $250,000, so I would do like two $200,000 checks.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was shocking. It was exhilarating. It was very addicting. You know, the fraud, the money, and so this was not my motivation to steal, but, you know, you talk about tone at the top, that's a big, you know, a big thing in the fraud world. The people that we worked for, the people I worked for, the executives, I didn't like them, and so it was fun to feel like I was screwing them over, you know, like, and that was very exhilarating.
And I think, again, people can relate to this because if we surveyed probably all the employees in the Chicagoland area, I'd say 75% would say, I don't love my bosses. I'm not into this mission. I don't, you know, and if I ever get the chance to get them,
I think that number is pretty darn accurate, 75%.
I'm going to get them.
I'm going to get them if I can.
One survey that's cited a lot says that something like 80% of workers would rip off their company if the opportunity presented itself.
And the opportunity and the ability to do it without getting caught.
Well, that's the opportunity.
Exactly. All right, everybody, hang on. We're going to talk more about this. Kelly Pope is here. Bill Kress is here. And Cressy. And I am Catherine Lake. And we're going to continue talking with Kelly's guest, Nathan Mueller, who is being... And is it Mueller or Mueller, Nathan? Can you tell me?
Is he? Mueller,
thank you. It's Mueller. He's a guy who has confessed and probably paid a little price for defrauding ING. And we're going to talk a little bit more about how that happens here on WGN's True Crime. I suspect Nick D is trolling the hallways looking for things to do. He's coming up here in about 20 minutes. Stick around for Nick D. I'm Catherine Lake. Kelly Pope here as well. Of course, it's True Crime on a Monday night, leaning into Tuesday here. And she brought in her Bill Kress as well, her partner in crime, with a podcast about. And the podcast again is called
Dupe of the Week.
Dupe of the Week. We need some Dupe of those weeks. We need to hear a few of those. But before we get back to that, We have Nathan Mueller on the phone, who is fascinating and so honest and so charming and so lovely that you are telling the truth about stealing $8.5 million from ING. How long ago was this, Nathan?
My fraud was between 2003 and 2007.
That was a long time. You got 4 years before they figured it out.
Yeah, that was shocking to me how long it went on.
And you pull 400 out in one day. I suppose it could get to 8.5 pretty quick. But I want to know what you did with the four. That's your first big day? Was that your first really big haul? And you thought, wow, I got to find a place for this. What do you do with that money, that check, when you get it out of the building?
What happened was, basically, as I was stealing the money, I understood that to buy things, to actually spend the money, I needed to come up with a reason to have it. So that was a big problem for me. You know, having an account, you know, a good accounting job and making a good income, I still couldn't start just buying big things, you know, cars and motorcycles and things I wanted. So I brainstormed about how I was going to legitimize the money. And so basically I started gambling, thinking that I would explain my extra money with gambling. And so what happened was I just got addicted to gambling. Oh. And my entire fraud flipped, where instead of using gambling to cover up my fraud, I started stealing just to gamble. And so that's all I did. I lost all the money at casinos and local here in Minnesota and in Vegas. And so, you know, that's where it all went. Those $400,000 days were just basically big weekends in Vegas.
Wow.
So you know something, that when I read the article that you wrote in the Journal of Accountancy, which I think is probably one of the best articles. I don't know if you ever used this or seen this in your class.
I think I did, now that you mentioned it.
But,
yeah.
And I don't know if this is in the article or if this was when we did our field trip with you, but when you told me that you paid the taxes on the money that you embezzled, I thought that that was the most fascinating and crazy thing at the same time. Do you remember saying that?
You're such a CPA.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I joke when I speak, you know, I didn't want to lose my license over this. So, you know, I reported all the money on my taxes.
Can you? Yeah, how does that work?
Okay, because
I need to go back.
Because he had cash and he paid the taxes.
So he
on
walks
it.
Home with a check in his two checks in his pocket. One day, I'm just sort of hanging on to this $400,000 day. $200,000 checks. You go to the bank and you put them in there and say, "Look at me, I had a good day at Vegas." Is that what you start with? You put it in the bank and then you go to Vegas and say, "Hey, I'm going to now spend some of this." Is that how it works? Or you just cash a check that you walk out the door with and then start?
Well, you had the company that you set up, you invoiced, you got a check.
Oh, you're setting up a dummy company.
There's a process that he's not explaining, just for the sake of time.
That's, well, I want the time. I feel you.
So he had a check. He didn't have to launder the money. He just had to get the check to Nathan Inc.
A new account.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
It. So again, it's not hard. Like, you could go and set up a company right now. All you need is an EIN number. You could do that. Go to the bank, have a bank account. Boom. Then you're the Catherine Lake LLC, and you provide a service, and you issue an invoice, and then you have the authority to go approve the invoice, and boom, you have a check. It's pretty easy. Yeah?
Right tonight, right now, we could go online and create an LLC, a limited liability company out of Nevada. A couple other states have all-night 24/7 services for doing that. And then you get that and you file the quick paper, again, online with the IRS. You got the employee ID number. You walk that paper into a bank.
Bank
boom,
boom.
You open up the checking account and
that's it.
And life's good. Yeah.
You have a business. And so then all you have to do now is invoice.
Fund it.
It's invoice. And so
what did you Nathan, what did you invoice this for? I'm guessing it's like soft services, like consulting or something.
No, thought where, just, and like you said, I set up a company, you know, back in the early 2000s, it wasn't all online, it wasn't so quick,
right.
But I got a federal ID number, I registered the name of my company with the Secretary of State, I got a business bank account, and I got a P.O. box, and I had a company, but I didn't have to invoice ING because I had a backdoor into PeopleSoft, into our system, to request checks that was not a way that anybody should ever do it. So I didn't have to set up a vendor. I could just request a check, approve it, and pick it up the next day, like basically, you know, on the down low. And,
yeah.
And then I could put that check right in my bank account. So like you said, I request those checks. I pick up two checks. You know, I have $400,000. I put them on my bank account. I go to Vegas. I didn't pay the tax man first, but in the end, yes, I reported all that money on my taxes, a good CPA.
Were you able to pay your taxes? Were you able to pay them with the cash that you got?
Since my fraud was multiple years, I paid my taxes the first few years. I got busted and my assets got froze before I could pay like my last year's taxes, but my taxes were all filed legitimately. There was no tax fraud involved because I honestly reported every dollar I stole as income to myself.
Unbelievable. It's an unbelievable detail.
There's an ethics professor. She's an emeritus now at Arizona State. Her name is Marianne Jennings. And one of the things that she has these seven steps about how to lead an ethical life or how people justify their decisions when they're engaged in unethical decisions. And one of them is you do good to atone for the bad.
Oh, sure.
And so you wanting to pay your taxes and feeling like that's the right thing to do was your way of saying, I know I'm doing something wrong, but now I'm sort of cleaning it up doing something right.
Right.
Was it that, Nathan, or was it that you knew that that would be an easy criminal prosecution, that you evaded taxes?
No.
I'll preface it by saying I know there was a case of a corrupt politician who was taking bribes, and when they busted him, they also charged him with tax evasion, but he had put on his 1040 under other income. He didn't write in bribes, but he just had the money there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the U.S. attorney had to drop the charge.
Can't have that one on
well,
there.
Well, you think about the famous case we talk about. Al Capone went to jail for what?
Tax evasion. Yeah.
Not Nathan. You just embezzled.
How did you get busted, Nathan? How did it happen?
It was multifaceted why I did it, in that I thought that's how I would get caught if I didn't do it that way, because I didn't want to have to launder the money. So I thought running it legit made it just a lot easier, because I didn't have to get around like the cash rules in Vegas and all that stuff. And then the other side of it was I knew that I didn't want a tax charge on top of the embezzlement charge. So, I mean, that's how that works. So how I got caught was, you know, I initially thought, in the world of, you know, corporate insurance and financial, you have audits constantly. So internal auditors, external auditors, Sarbanes-Oxley consultants, and state insurance examiners. So I got past them, and then I thought maybe the IRS would come digging just based on my income growth over that time. And no. And so how I got busted was internally, my best friend at work, one of the smartest people I know, the person whose password I was using to commit the crime. And it, basically what happened was, you know, we had received erroneously this signing authority, and one day accounts payable, ING's accounts payable, figured out that we had all this signing authority and there was no paperwork. There was no approvals for it. So they sent us an email and said, hey, if you guys want to keep your signing authority, you need to have this paperwork filled out and approved properly. And at that point, my coworker and my boss found out that we had this signing authority that I've been abusing for years. And at that point, that's when she started digging, found that she basically ran a query in 2007 of her user ID, and she found out that she had approved $1 million in checks in 2007.
Oh my gosh.
And she obviously knew she didn't approve anything, and so that's what really kicked it off. So
your best friend was your whistleblower. Your best friend at work.
Yep.
That's amazing. And so did she do the right thing? Did she come to you? Did she go to the supervisor? Did she go to the FBI? What was her next step?
So, yeah, she did the right thing. She protected herself. She went to our boss and gave him that information, and that's what led him to come back to me. And I was the manager of the payment process, so he came to me and asked me about all these checks.
What's going on here?
Where's the backup for these? And I thought that he was confronting me as the perpetrator, but he was asking me as the manager of the process.
Help me figure this out, pal. what do we got to do to figure this out? And you're sick to your stomach. And you don't answer right then. You just say, "Boy, I'll have to take a look at that."
How did you react?
How did you react?
Did you say, it wasn't me, or was it just kind of playing along with this whole thing? Or did you feel like you were being accused?
No, I thought I was being accused. It was a weird thing, because that day, the girl that worked for me that handled all of, say that those had been legitimate payments, the person that should have had the backup for those payments, she happened to be out that day. That's Friday afternoon. And so I talked my way out of the office that day saying, she's gone. I don't know where she keeps it. He said, okay, we'll pick it up on Monday. So I went home that Friday thinking, I'm busted. I'm done. And so literally I was contemplating suicide. Or I need to get a lawyer, and I need to, confront this. And so I decided I need to confront this. I got a lawyer that Friday night. I met with him Saturday. I spent Saturday trying to cover my tracks and creating fake documentation. And I went in Monday morning and I presented my fake documentation to my boss, which was, it looked completely legitimate. And at that point, he said, well, I just need to go and show this, to our CFO.
So, Nathan, I'm going to back you up one second. Were you honest with your lawyer, or were you manipulating your lawyer over that weekend too?
No, 100%. It was such a relief for me to talk about it, because I had never told anybody. So to go into my lawyer's office and say, here's what I did, it was everything off my shoulders. I finally had somebody on my side. I wasn't by myself. I wasn't in it alone. I had somebody with me.
But you set him aside. You set your attorney aside and thought, well, I'm going to still try and cover this. The attorney was there as a backup and a relief, but then you still went in on Monday and still tried to say, well, here's an explanation for this that maybe you'll buy.
Yeah, and so what my lawyer wanted was, he wanted me to go into the office on Monday, and he basically said, we need to know what they know. And so I wanted to talk about as soon as he walked away from, to him, he said, oh, that makes sense. But then he went to show it to his boss, his boss was the person whose signature I faked in all my fake documentation. So I was like, okay, they're going to know as soon as he gets upstairs. So I literally ran to my car and, squealed out of the parking lot.
Oh, my gosh.
At that point, and I did find out later, they had no idea I was involved until I ran to my car and squealed out of the parking lot.
Nathan, I'm writing this script as I'm going here. This is amazing. You probably already have a deal with ABC, right? That's okay. That's amazing. It's amazing, and I'm right with you. I'm right with you. Who hasn't, at some point in their life, even if they're 12, been caught in a conflict, been caught in a lie, and that feeling in your stomach where you just want to throw up and run?
I mean, it was horrible.
So who's going to play in the movie now?
Yeah, really. Is it going to be Brad Pitt? It's going to be Brad Pitt. It's going to be Brad Pitt. I know it's going to be Brad Pitt. Kelly said it's going to be Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any other questions, Kelly? She's just shaking her head too, because it really is remarkable. And what's most remarkable for me is that you are able to talk about it like you do. It is such a gift. I feel like you have turned a complete corner, and understand what you did, and understand the benefit of talking to people about it.
Two quick questions, Nathan. One, how much, if any, did you have to pay back? And two, how much time did you serve?
So restitution-wise, I mean, I owe the whole amount. So I've paid back about $1 million of the $8.5 million, so I still owe about $7.5 million. So, you know, I pay restitution on a monthly basis.
Wow.
And
that's going to take a little while.
Yeah, normally what happens is it's a 20-year thing, so it goes on for 20 years. So, and they can decide to refile that. So, but you pay, they're reasonable in that they don't take everything I make. They make sure I can pay my child support and support my family. But they take, you know, they take what I think is reasonable for them to take, you know. And obviously I wish I could pay it all off, but I'm not in a great earning situation right now.
I wish I had. I'm like, what do you got on you? I've got a few bucks over here. No. Well, speaking.
Spent any time?
As far as part two is, I was sentenced to 97 months, you know, in federal prison. So that's 8 years, basically. So my good time, you get your good time on day one. That was a year. And then I completed RDAP, which is a residential drug abuse program, which if you can prove, you know, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, in my case, gambling abuse, you can do this 40-week residential drug program and get
that. Get a little time back, right?
And then you do your last, you find.
Darn it. Cell phones.
6 months and 17 days in prison. Then 6 months of home confinement, and then 3 years of probation. I got off my probation early, just as I guess I would call myself an honest fraudster. You know, the judge saw that I wasn't up to my business. I've just been out of prison, which I think Kelly can attest to, as she was in my apartment about 5 weeks after I got
out
of prison.
I know, isn't that wild, Nathan? We this professor and like what 10 students and a camera and come to your house and you're like, hey,
come on in, let me tell you my story. Well, it is remarkable, and I can hear the journey you have taken and how you have come out on the side of light at the end. I don't want to be too sappy about it, but I'm just grateful. I'm grateful that you're telling your story. And if you are not a speaker yet,
he's a speaker.
You are a speaker. Get to me through Kelly, because I know how to market speakers, and I want to get you out there telling your story. Because I was a member of ING for a while. It's just, it's astounding. It's astounding, your journey.
Oh, come on! You just want to beat Brad Pitt.
I just want to meet Brad Pitt. That's right.
Nathan, thank you so much for staying up. I know you have a new baby, so thank you so much. I'm sure you may be up anyway, but I appreciate your time so much for sharing.
Thank you, Nathan.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll be seeing you on the speaker circuit. Thanks again, Nathan. Wow, what an incredible story. You know how to bring it, Kelly Pope. You know how to bring it, girl. These are really interesting stories. Now, we've got a couple minutes left before Nick Dean needs to take over the airwaves. Yeah. These dupes of the week. Well, tell me what you do with your podcast.
So since we just have a little couple minutes, why don't we just talk about what's been your favorite dupe story?
Oh, my goodness. A favorite dupe story is, it's too complicated to describe. It was, but somebody who figured out how to work around the controls that Amazon has on its Amazon marketplace so as to rip people off.
Oh.
And it includes, apparently, doing research on small-town newspapers to find out people who have died so you could get that zip code and then use that when you send out a phony package, and then you'd get the tracking showing that the package was delivered, and then they get paid for a sale of a device that was never mailed out in the first place.
Okay, so my takeaway from this is Amazon has some work to do.
Well, they put in this really intense control, but the bad guys will still figure out ways to get around it.
Unbelievable.
So my favorite dupe.
Well, I gotta tell you, I gotta take a quick break, and we might have time for it. We might have to do it next time.
Might have to wait.
So we'll quick break here, and then we're gonna get to Nick Dewey, and we're gonna get some news before that. So just stick around on WGN.